It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we look at ongoing emergency response to severe flooding in northern Wisconsin, where Governor Walker declared a state of emergency. First, Milwaukee police districts have been instructed to send officers out in two-person squads. That instruction was announced by the Milwaukee Police Department in the wake of a shooting that severely injured police officer Brandon Baranowski on Sunday. In a recent media release, the Milwaukee Police Association, a union for the police officers, forensic investigators, and detectives of Milwaukee, talked about the shooting that wounded Baranowski and also supported the decision to have two-person squads. I talked to Mike Crivello earlier today. He's president of the Milwaukee Police Association. Mike, welcome to the show.
Absolutely, and thank you for having me on.
Well, before we get into the idea of two-person squads out on patrol, I just wanted to ask how is Officer Baranowski doing right now?
Well, I thank you for asking. I will tell you that he did have surgery this morning. Hopefully he is now out of surgery, but I don't know that to be fact. We are hoping and praying that everything went well. I will tell you that I had an opportunity to spend some time with him early Sunday morning, and at that time, relatively speaking, he was in good spirits.
Well, best to him and his family, and hopefully a speedy recovery.
Now, thank you for that.
This idea of two-person squads, this didn't just come out from this weekend. You've been talking about this for a while, haven't you?
The two-man squad issue, the staffing issue, I have been talking about nearly from day one of me arriving in the position that I'm currently in. It is a security situation that we need to address.
For someone not familiar with police procedure, can you talk us through why it would make such a difference to have two police officers together on patrol versus one? Kind of obvious maybe in some ways, but talk us through it.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I totally understand where, average citizen out there might not understand the value of having two people in a car as opposed to one, and I respect that. But for those officers that are riding together, it makes them more effective, more efficient. And how does that happen? That happens because if an officer is dispatched to an assignment that would require two men or two officers, which so many of, nearly all of our assignments do require two officers, in order to fulfill that need, you'd have to have one officer arrive, get dispatched, stage down the street, which means hold up short of the assignment and wait for the next officer to arrive on scene. So there goes your efficiency. There goes your opportunity to be effective as far as answering that call as timely as you possibly can. Now, our officers are true professionals, and they hear that call for help. They are going to respond, whether they're one man or two man, and to some degree at their own peril. In a situation where use of force may have to be used because you're there by yourself. So there's another advantage of having two men respond to calls. It ultimately affords us an opportunity to minimize our use of force.
Could it be a deterrent to the a suspect using force against an officer? They might be, bolder if there's only one officer, as opposed to two officers on the scene.
Well, you're absolutely correct, and we have witnessed that. We have witnessed situations where the way you describe it, the suspect is emboldened by the fact that they might be able to fight their way out of this situation and overpower the officer, while if you have two officers, the likelihood of that happening is greatly diminished.
Now, with what happened this weekend with Officer Baranowski, I know it's speculating to say what might have gone differently, but do you think having a second officer in the car on the scene would have made a difference?
I am confident that a second officer in the car would have made a difference. Now, I'm not trying to fool anybody here. I totally understand that two officers in a car could equally be harmed because it is a very difficult environment that we are currently policing in and that we have been policing in for quite some time. But when two officers are working together in a situation like that where one officer has to take some notes or has to catch up a report or has to file information relative to the assignment that he just tentatively concluded, the other officer has his eyes and awareness up and out from the squad car, aware of what's going on in that environment around him.
A response I've seen, Mike, is that in a perfect world, sure, we'd always do this, but resources can be stretched thin. Maybe if we're having to have two officers together, we're not covering as wide an area as we could by splitting them up. What do you say to that?
Well, again, you know, I'll go back to the effectiveness, efficiency of it. If one officer is patrolling by himself, he has the same concerns that any other motor vehicle operator would have, the person running across the street, the traffic in front of him, and all those other things, while at the same time, he needs to be cognizant of the environment around him. He may drive, and I would bet that any of your listeners might say, an officer drove right by me while I was waving at him for help, or I saw somebody in need of an officer, and they just drove right past. Because they missed it because they didn't have the availability of that second partner. When two people are in a car, the likelihood of that happening is, greatly reduced.
Talking to Mike Crivello, president of the Milwaukee Police Association, about two officer squads in Milwaukee and police safety more generally. And Mike, of course, we had the shootings of police officers in Dallas, your colleagues in Baton Rouge, the horrible events there this weekend. Talking to the officers you work with, I assume they're watching this. They're trying to process this. What are you hearing from them?
Well, I'll tell you, all of our hearts weigh heavy for those officers and their families that have been affected, negatively forevermore. You know, there's many people that are not going home to their children, their wives, or what have you. And so the officers that are here in this city, believe me, they think about that. And they think about their own safety. And if we cannot keep our own officers safe, if we can't properly equip them and position them so that they are safe enough themselves, then how will they ultimately keep our community safe? So they think about that, and that has an effect on morale. We are so fortunate that the officers, I am so fortunate that the officers that I have the opportunity to represent are absolute true professionals, and they will do everything they can to keep our community safe. But at the same time, they need to go home to their families as well.
What do the officers in your community want to see from community leaders, police leadership, the community itself?
They are calling for a unity of message. And what is meant by that is they need to know that the administration, both at the police department, seventh floor level, and that's where the chief is and what have you, and City Hall has made that statement of absolute support for the officers. And they need to know that when they go to work, that they have everything in place that will mitigate those security concerns and ultimately heighten their opportunity to go home at night.
A lot of people obviously protesting over the last couple of years about the shootings of mostly younger black men. Is there a way to have that conversation and the conversation about keeping the police officers themselves safe and maybe lowering the tensions and trying to talk about both of those issues?
Oh, I think there is. I would tell you, if there is truth and honesty amongst all that engage in those conversations, we can get through this. We truly can. But where that honesty has to come in is that, and people have to understand this, our citizens have to understand this, and I will tell you that I believe that 95% of them do, that no officer ever wants to utilize deadly force or any type of force in the course of their duty. When they are, when they do, the situation is what caused it. So, yeah, can we get beyond it? Can we get through it? Yes. But it has to be through honest dialogue and leadership united, not just half of them or a couple of them, but everyone sending the same message to the community.
Mike, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
That was Mike Crivello, president of the Milwaukee Police Association. He told us about the Milwaukee Police Department's announcement that it would send officers out in two-person squads. You're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we're just over halfway through 2016, and there's been a lot of great music released this year. We'll talk to Stephen Thompson from NPR Music about some of the greatest albums of the year so far. First, we're taking a look at northern Wisconsin, where torrential rainfall and flooding last week claimed the lives of three people, and where FEMA announced today that it's going to get involved by doing a preliminary assessment of the damage. Governor Scott Walker declared a state of emergency in eight northern Wisconsin counties, as well as tribal lands of the Bad River and Red Cliff bands of the Lake Superior Chippewa tribe. Local and tribal officials say recovery costs will run in the tens of millions of dollars. Scott Neitzel joins us now. He's Secretary of Wisconsin's Department of Administration. Secretary Neitzel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Well, from your perch in the DOA, what does this look like? How bad is the damage for those of us in the rest of the state? What's going on in northern Wisconsin?
Well, it's very severe. As you indicated last Monday, the area, there was just a storm that went through that just kind of sat over northwestern Wisconsin and dumped 11-plus inches of rain from Monday night into Tuesday morning. And for those of your listeners who are familiar with that area and the topography and kind of the soil makeup, it just couldn't absorb that much rain. Usually most areas can't. And so what we had was a number of small streams just, have an amount of water flowing through them that you just really can't imagine. If you look at some of the readings that the Department of Natural Resources had on their flow meters, they showed us one stream that went from about 400 cubic feet per second to over 7,000 cubic feet per second, just in a matter of minutes. So this was just a massive amount of water, which caused a lot of very severe damage and a true natural disaster for some areas up there. And as you referenced, a personal tragedy as we lost three of our fellow citizens.
The big question now is, how does that region pick up the pieces? And I know you've met with and been in contact with local leaders out there. What kind of things are you hearing from them about their top priorities?
Yeah, if you go back in time, you know, after the governor issued, the governor was up there on Tuesday, last Tuesday, issued the emergency declaration, and then that allows the state to bring to bear all its resources. And we also then at that time implemented the Wisconsin Emergency Management Systems Operations Center, which allows all the state agencies in one room. We have one room where all the state agencies can get together and then communicate with the local emergency management and first responders in the area. So that's kind of how the state's response started. And then working through those issues, identifying the issues, and determining which agencies were in the best position to help the locals. And I think we have to point out here that the local units of government in the area and the first responders have just done a fantastic job under very, very severe circumstances. And so then last Friday, myself, along with a number of other cabinet agencies, met with local governments and first responders in the area just to assess, okay, you know, where is the most need and where can the state help the most? And that's the meeting we had last Friday. What we're really focusing on is to make sure that we're very coordinated, you know, amongst the various branches of government, that what we're doing is effective, and that we make sure that it's sustainable. So to your question then, on the areas of most needs, at this point, I think there are a couple of things. One, local roads, mm-hmm. state and federal roads, but also town roads. People, always think about, U.S. Highway 2, 63, Highway 13, but there are a number of town roads in that area that were also damaged. And what we heard from the local officials is roads seem to be like the number one area of concern. Two was just kind of what I'd refer to as technical assistance, which kind of comes in two areas. One, kind of expertise on the ground to help assess the damage, and two, the ability or kind of training in how do you fill out all the paperwork. And then three was a concern just financially, how do the local units of government kind of get through this up until the federal government were to declare a federal disaster area.
I think I saw through your department, the Department of Administration, there was something, an emergency community development block grant. I usually think of those grants as long-term economic development, but there's an emergency side of that as well?
Yeah, there is, and actually today I can also report that the Department of Transportation got a $2.5 million emergency grant from the Federal Highway Administration to help with some of the state roads. And as the FEMA comes in at the governor's request to do the damage assessment next week, hopefully move that along and get that determination from the president and free up some more dollars to help all kind of levels of government and citizens get the help that they need.
I've seen cost tolls that are kind of works in progress estimates based on who's reported so far. Are we starting to get a picture of how much economic cost there's going to be from all levels?
Yeah, to this point, you know, and it was because of some of the just assessing the area, the damage reports and assessments were, you know, it took a while, but what we've seen to date, right now we're looking at probably about almost $29 million in public infrastructure costs, and just a little under $2 million in damage to homes and businesses in the area, and that's as of today.
We're talking to Scott Neitzel. He's Secretary of Wisconsin's Department of Administration. We're looking at the cleanup and recovery efforts after last week's storms and flooding in northern Wisconsin, a state of emergency in a bunch of counties up there. Secretary Neitzel, looking at a timeline for all this, it looks like, I mean, just looking at some of the pictures up there of the highways, this is not going to be done overnight.
No, that's true, although I believe Highway 2 will be fully functional later this week, which will be good news because that is the main east-west thoroughfare through through northern Wisconsin there. You know, and we're going to move as quickly as we can. You know, here again, going back to what we heard from the residents in the area, transportation seems to be the most urgent need. The other thing, though, that I want to point out, and I hope this isn't forgotten to your listeners, is that almost all the businesses in the area are still open. So while we have some localized road outages, and while the damage is very severe in some areas, what we also heard from the locals up there is tell people we're still open for business. Tell people that most of the attractions, most of the motels, hotels, family-run businesses are still open in the area. I can tell you when we were up there on Friday, the weather was absolutely spectacular. So I would hope your listeners, if they have plans, would just call ahead and check in because there's most of the businesses are open and you know, the July and August time frame, very important to the tourism industry in northwestern Wisconsin, and we'd hate to have kind of a double disaster if people didn't show up.
I was going to say, this is peak time up in those parts of the state. Are people, from what we know, are people still showing up for their you know, cabin reservation or what have you?
Yes, I believe they are. I mean, these the state Department of Tourism has been working with the local tourism officials to get that word out. And I would encourage listeners also to go to ready.wi.gov, which kind of has the a full assessment and can get to various tourism websites and so on. So it's just, you know, as easy as that, ready.wi.gov.
And I wonder, I hate to think about the next disaster, but are there lessons we're learning from what happened last week and the response so far that might apply in, knock on wood, it's going to be a long time, the next time something like this hits?
Well, I think you, you know, you're always in the process of learning. You know, we've been better prepared for this response than say we were, you know, 5 years ago. And you just keep building on what you learn. So I think you look at every one of these as I know, after we get done, what's the lessons learned? What could we have done better? What went well? And just build off of those.
Now, we've heard in the past with some major disasters, difficulty sometimes coordinating between federal and state and local relief efforts. Do you see that working fairly smoothly from what you've seen with FEMA now coming in and doing an assessment?
Yeah, I mean, between the state and the locals, we've had just great cooperation. You know, like I said, we had the Wisconsin Emergency Management Systems Operations Center up and going. When we were in Ashland last Friday, we heard from a number of the local electeds that the communication has been very good on the things that we know and can communicate back and forth. And, you know, that's been one thing that we always focus on is the cooperation and communication. Here again, having that face-to-face meeting was also very helpful. It's just you can't emphasize that enough. And I know that, you know, throughout the year, there are various exercises that Wisconsin Emergency Management does, which builds those relationships in all the regions of the state. So I think we do a pretty good job, but you can always, always learn from every situation.
So what's the timeline moving forward for you and your fellow cabinet officials and the local relief efforts?
Well, I think, you know, we're just, our thing is just to stick to it, do the basic blocking and tackling, and stick with it as long as needed to get everything back to where it was pre-last Monday night.
All right, Secretary Neitzel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Wisconsin Department of Administration Secretary Scott Neitzel, looking at the ongoing emergency response to severe flooding in northern Wisconsin. And by the way, I want to ask you, if you live in that area, now that you've maybe had time to dig out a little bit, love to hear about your experiences. If you have pictures you'd like to share with us, you can do that. You could tweet us at Central Time WPR or head over to the Central Time Facebook page, put up a post, or send us a message there. Let us know how last week's storms and flooding affected you, your business, your roads, your neighborhood. Again, tweet us at Central Time WPR or share that with us on the Central Time Facebook page. Coming up after the news, we'll talk about the best albums released so far in 2016. Lev, Stephen Thompson of the Wisconsin Thompsons, by the way, he's now with NPR Music, and he's got a lot of great music to share with us. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. We're listening to Burn the Witch by Radiohead. It's off their new album, A Moon-Shaped Pool, which just came out this year. Even though we're only halfway through 2016, a lot has gone down in the music world so far. Beyonce dropped her visual album, Lemonade, on HBO. Paul Simon released a new album, and David Bowie's final album came out just 2 days before his death. NPR has put together a list of their 30 favorite albums of 2016 so far. You can see that NPR music list on the Central Time Facebook page. I want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What's your favorite album or song that's come out so far this year? What new tracks have really caught your ear? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Stephen Thompson is with us now. He's editor and writer for NPR Music and a weekly panelist on NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour. Stephen, good to have you back.
That's great to be here, Rob.
Well, a good year for music so far, Stephen.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, typically around this time every year, we're putting together the best music of the year so far. So we do one kind of at the six-month mark and then another one right at the end of the year. And typically we do 50 albums at the end of the year and 25 at mid-year. And we had all these meetings and we couldn't whittle it down to 25. And so we just said, you know what? No one is holding, there are no laws governing this process. So we went ahead and did 30 albums. And of course, NPR Music covers music across genre. So, you know, a lot of the titles you listed were really big pop and rock records, but we were also addressing classical and jazz and hip hop and you know, in many, many different genres.
So good that you couldn't narrow it down to just 25.
That's right. That's right. You just come and you know, try to take those five albums away from us.
Now, before we get to listen to some of that music, Stephen, I want to talk about the idea of music discovery. We keep seeing science or whatever coming out saying, your musical tastes are locked in at, enter year here, late 20s, 29, 33
sure.
years old, something like that. Why is it important for us to keep finding the new stuff, to not just lock in on our golden years or early days stuff?
Well, I think I'm sure there is science to that. I'm sure our brains, evolve and, start forming more in some ways and stop forming in other ways. But I think that's situational as much as scientific. I think that everybody reaches a point, no matter how obsessed you are with music when you're a kid or when you're in college, your life is going to carry on and you're going to have more and more and more forces drawing you away from discovering new music. You're going to have, you got a job, you got a mortgage, you got a family, and those things take away from a love of music. And one of the things that I think of as our job at NPR Music is to do a lot of sifting and winnowing for the benefit of those people. People who use, it's a little Wisconsin.
Thank you. Yeah.
I throw that out there as an Easter egg all the time, sifting and winnowing. But, we're there to listen to tons and tons and tons of music so that people who would love to be listening to tons and tons of music can just kind of get to the good stuff more quickly.
Well, let's get to some of the good stuff. You've got a lot of variety for us. So let's get into it. Here, we'll give a listen. Anderson .Paak, I hope I'm saying it right, and this track is called The Season I Carry Me.
6 years old, I tried my first pair of Jordans on. Mama, can you carry me? It was late in the fall, I caught a glimpse of my first love. My God, Mama, can you carry me? Knees hit the floor, screams to the Lord.
So tell us a little bit about the artist first, Stephen, Anderson .Paak.
Yeah, Anderson .Paak, he's a singer and rapper from Oakland. He first became well-known last year when he appeared on the Straight Outta Compton album that Dr. Dre put together. And, so he kind of has that stamp of approval from Dr. Dre, and everybody was waiting for this for him to put out this new record, which came out way back in, January, and yet it's this incredible, sprawling kind of summertime record. So it's a record I've been listening to all year and that many of us kind of across the board at NPR Music really, really love.
And is that one track pretty representative, or is there a lot of variety within the album?
He's going in a lot of different directions. I got to see a full concert of his, and he is he's kind of a full band leader showman, it's not sticking with one genre. There is, as you could tell kind of from that excerpt, there's a lot of kind of classic soul running through it as well. It's a really cool, fascinating, kind of endlessly rewarding record.
So that was a name I didn't know. Here's one that I did. Beyonce. Now, I will say, I appreciate her skill and artistry. I haven't always been, it's not always my kind of stuff. But the track you sent us from this album, pretty good. And I realize I owned it, actually, because I bought it for one of my kids but hadn't listened to it. So this is the song of Freedom. We'll give a listen here.
I'm telling these tears going fall away, oh. May the last one burn into flame. Keep on running because the winner don't quit on themselves.
All right, I play that one longer than I normally do because there's a lot of great pieces that come together there really well, Stephen.
I think she's extraordinary. I'm a huge, huge Beyonce fan, particularly these last few records, as she has fully come into her own as I think a powerhouse. And I know that Beyonce can be divisive, and that we probably I've probably get more blowback when I rave about Beyonce than when I rave about anybody else. But this album Lemonade got a lot of attention right when it came out because it's a response record to a lot of personal turmoil in her life, in her marriage to Jay-Z, and everyone was kind of picking it apart, for more details about their lives. But it's also, it kind of ends with this string of really beautiful songs, several of which, like Freedom, which has the rapper Kendrick Lamar on it, which are very anthemic and very current. They feel very of the moment.
But they're also, I see callbacks to gospel and soul and rock and just that, just so much in that one, just that 40 seconds of music we just heard.
She is not just a pop singer, and I sometimes hear people who will push back and just be like, ugh, pop music, blah. It's so inventively made and drawing on so much great stuff that came before it, and yet it sounds very, very current.
Talking to Stephen Thompson from NPR Music, looking at some of the best music of 2016 so far. A good year for music, according to NPR Music. Here's another one. We're going to listen to a lot more here. Anoni, am I saying this right? This is another one that's new to me.
Anoni, yeah.
Anoni.
You may have heard of her. She used to make records as the head of Anthony and the Johnsons, she's a trans woman, and she made this incredibly. Well, you want to play a little bit of it?
Yeah, this is the song "Drone Bomb Me." Here it is.
So drone bomb me.
So almost melodramatic there. I mean, I think back in the 80s to Morrissey and the Smiths, it makes that look downright cheerful, Stephen. is that an indication of the rest of the album here?
Yeah, this is a bleak record. This is a very dark and powerful statement of a record, and it's very, very political. It can be abrasive, but you know, when she was making records before as Anthony and the Johnsons, they had a little bit more of a kind of hopeful quality to them and a really searching quality. This record is much more violent in its imagery and to I think really, really powerful effect.
Yeah, what is it that's grabbing people about this album? I mean, you mentioned very, very bleak, yet people are gathering around it.
Well, I think part of what people are gathering around is it is a very, very bold and evocative statement. This is an artist who has a tremendous amount to say about a tremendous number of issues. And you know, we're always looking for music that challenges us or kind of gets under the skin and pokes around a little bit.
Well, let's go to maybe the polar opposite in the list you sent us here. In the country genre, we'll give a listen to the song "Rich" by Maren Morris.
A dollar every time that I swore you off, and a 20 every time that I picked up when you called, and a crisp new Benjamin for when you hear that gone again, and a dollar every time I was right about you after all.
Pretty straight ahead, a little slower tempo than you might expect from this kind of country song. A very simple metaphor. You treat me badly. If I had a dollar for every time you did it, I'd be rich.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think the simplicity of that is fantastic. You know, you cannot go wrong with a big summer kiss-off song. And that's
your summertime breakup music for the year, people.
Yeah, it's just, I'm mad, you big liar. And the song has this very classic kind of timeless feel. If you listen to the kind of hook that was running underneath the verse, it's very almost like the Joker by the Steve Miller
band. I was just going to say, it sounded like Steve Miller. Yeah, I wanted the bass to do one more thing and lock into
yeah,
that. Yeah,
and I think that kind of classic feel, you know, mixed with just like a young, really bright country singer who's making these, you know, big, great anthems. She had an anthem kind of over the winter months called "My Church" that was her breakthrough country hit, and I think she's terrific.
This is a drive around with the windows down kind of
yeah,
kind of album.
And it's summertime, man.
We're talking to Stephen Thompson from NPR Music now, looking at the 30 best albums. Well, we won't get to all of them, but some of the best albums of 2016 so far. And we're taking your calls now, too, at 800-642-1234. What's your favorite song or album you've heard so far that came out this year? Where do you go to find out about new music? Radio, streaming service? Word on the street? What are you excited to listen to once it comes out later this year? Are you anticipating a new release? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll pick up the discussion, get to your calls after a little break here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation now with Stephen Thompson from NPR Music, looking at the best albums that have come out so far in 2016. You could join in with your favorite new album, new song, at 800-642-1234. What new music are you getting into? What do you like or not about the tracks we've played so far? Where do you go to find out about new music? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to a caller now. Colin is on the line in Eagle River. Colin, hi.
Hi, yeah. I'd just like to say that my number one album for the year has got to be Cartoon Moon by a band called Dead Horses out of Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
I've heard of it. Can you describe the album, Colin? Because I don't think I've heard the album myself.
You know, the instrumentation is they have a couple of guitars and a stand-up bass. One of the guitars playing rhythm, the other one taking leads. And they also have on this album, I believe it's some of the drum tracks are the former drummer of Wilco.
Oh.
And they also have Gnome Kelney, the banjo picker, playing on a track.
All right.
But it is just outstanding, the entire album.
Colin, thanks so much for that suggestion. Always good to hear good Wisconsin bands. And Stephen, by the way, I don't know if you've been following our set list summer music series.
Mm-hmm.
People can check out a lot of great Wisconsin and regional bands at WPR.org/setlist. You're from Wisconsin, Stephen. You're sifting and winnowing. Anybody you're keeping an eye on back home here?
Well, I mean, I just, it's funny, Colin mentioned Dead Horses from Oshkosh. I just wrote down Dead Horses from Oshkosh on my notes so I can check it out.
Good.
You know, there are definitely, you know, I'm you know, a huge fan of Bon Iver. I'm always dying to get up to the Eau Claire Festival and have not yet done so. But, you know, every now and then, you know, I put together like a South by Southwest playlist every year through NPR Music. And I'm always kind of trying to peek at Wisconsin bands and listen extra closely. There's a band from Milwaukee called Paper Holland that I put on there a couple of years ago. I was Trapper Shep I put on this past year from Milwaukee. So, you know, I definitely try to keep a little bit of an extra unit of ear on any artists who are from Wisconsin.
Colin, thanks for that suggestion. We'll go now to Brian in Milwaukee. Brian, hi.
Oh, hi. I was telling a screener, I most recently liked this group called Lucius. They're out of Chicago. Mm-hmm. They have an album called Good Grief, I think is their latest album. Two female singers. They're just an interesting live band as well. And I've been tapping into Stephen Colbert on a regular basis to see new bands.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, I don't remember him singing, though he's got a good singing voice, I guess. Brian, thanks so much for that. Lucius rings a bell. Have you told us about Lucius before, Stephen?
I may have talked about Lucius on this show before. I really, really love him. The two singers, Holly Lessig and Jess Wolf, they sing, they don't so much harmonize as sing in unison. And so you have these two really, really strong voices that are doing the same thing at the same time, and it really gives their songs kind of verve and power. As Brian said, a really great live band, just getting better and better. You can go back a few years. We did a Tiny Desk concert in the NPR Music offices with them. They're a longtime favorite of ours.
Brian, thanks a lot for that suggestion. Let's get back to some of the tracks you shared with us today, Stephen. And this has been a year, of course, of loss in the musical world. Prince passed away, and of course David Bowie, but he released an album just before he died. And here's a listen to one of the tracks from Black Star by David Bowie. This is I Can't Give Everything Away.
Seeing more and feeling less, saying no but meaning yes. This is all I ever meant. That's the message that I sent.
And Stephen, a lot of ways the album felt like a goodbye, didn't it?
Yeah, boy. You know, it came out a couple days before he died, and this record's so interesting. A few months before it came out, I was getting word, you know, floating around like, oh, there's going to be a David Bowie record, and it's like a jazz record. This is going to be like his jazz record. And I kind of rolled my eyes like, oh, boy. And I think what people meant by that was he just has all of these incredibly accomplished players playing with him and that he was looking
right.
at different forms. But so, like, you know, it was coming out like January 7th, and I thought, oh, boy, that's kind of, they're kind of burying it. And once it came out and once I got a copy of it, I was absolutely floored by it. And just, it just felt like he was in peak form. And so it made his death feel that much more shocking. And then it cast this album in a very, very different light that it really is. I mean, that this song that you just played, I Can't Give Everything Away, that's the last song on the record, and it feels very much like a final statement. It's a beautiful record, even outside the context of the incredible sadness that envelops it.
Talking to Stephen Thompson from NPR Music, looking at some of the best albums released so far in 2016. Here's another one. This one I'm not familiar with. The artist is Mitski. Before we give a listen, can you tell us a little bit about her?
She is amazing. She's been she's been floating around for a couple of years. You know, she put out a record a year or two ago that a lot of us really liked. You know, we liked her enough. You know, we put her on our South by Southwest showcase lineup. She's definitely an artist that we've been keeping an eye on. And then this record, it's called Puberty 2, and it's just this fascinating character study that gets incredibly intense at times. And the song we're going to hear is my favorite song of the record, and maybe my favorite song of the year.
Wow.
Called Your Best American Girl.
You're all I ever.
Powerful climax of the song there, Stephen. It's kind of ethereal for quite a while leading up to that point, as I recall. This is maybe your favorite song of the year, you're saying.
Yeah, this song just hits incredibly hard. You know, those guitars in that chorus, they make the hair on the back of my neck stand up. And when you start to unpack the lyrics of the song, it's all about identity, cultural identity, figuring out who you are and what you want to be. It's a powerhouse record.
Now here's another one that fits into the cultural identity theme, and again, a new one to me, Senya Rubinos, a new album called Black Terry Cat, and this track is called Mexican Chef.
French bistro, Dominican chef, Italian restaurant, Boricua chef, Chinese takeout, Mexican chef, new for America, but to the end of that, it's a French bistro, Dominican chef, Italian restaurant, Boricua chef, Chinese takeout, Mexican chef, new for America, but to the end of that.
Brown monster, baby, brown monster dog, brown raised America, picks up its mom, brown cleans your house, brown takes the trash, brown even with.
So, and a lot going on there, and a great groove behind that one. Talk about it a little.
You said there's an incredible groove behind it, but there's also, as you can tell, as you unpack the words she's saying, you know, it's a message song. It's about the way Latino workers are sort of forming the backbone of American work, and commenting off of that. And so what you really get in that song is this, is you have that message and you have somebody with a very strong point of view, but you also have somebody who is very, very playful in the way that the music's coming together. And so it's very, it's stimulating, for lack of a better word. It's just pinging all these different parts of your brain. She's really, really cool.
And let's get to one. Now, this guy, it's a weird coincidence. He has the same name as that guy from Simon and Garfunkel, the guy who did the Grace. Oh, no, wait, it's the same guy. There's a new Paul Simon album. Before we listen, I didn't know that was coming.
Yeah, it's been out for a few weeks now, and it was funny. I was listening to the song "Graceland" in the car with my girlfriend this morning, and we were just marveling over the fact that Paul Simon's been around for, you know, what, like 50 years, making music for something like 50 years, and he never really had a fallow period. You know, he never put out records that stunk. And that's an incredibly remarkable thing for a musician to do. And this record is called "Stranger to Stranger," and it's just another really, really strong record of Paul Simon songs.
All right, here's a little from the track called "The Werewolf."
The werewolf's coming, the werewolf's coming, yes, the werewolf is coming, Joe. I hear her howling, prowling on the hill, the werewolf's coming, Bill. Ignorance and arrogance, a national debate. Put the fight in Vegas, that's a billion-dollar game.
That's Paul Simon, The Werewolf, from his newest release. Stephen, briefly, what's the next album you're looking forward to dropping?
Oh man, well there are a couple that I just found out about that I actually am not allowed to talk about yet because they have not been announced, and I'm such a terrible tease. But I will say there are a couple of really, really big ones coming out this year that people are going to be very excited about.
All right, well, something secret to look forward to. Stephen, thanks. It's always a lot of fun to share some music with you.
Oh, anytime, Rob. Thanks so much for having me.
We've been talking to Stephen Thompson. He's editor and writer for NPR Music, weekly panelist on NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour. He joins us to talk about NPR Music's 30 favorite albums of 2016 so far. Still time to share some of your favorite releases and find a link to that top 30 list, by the way. Head over to the Central Time Facebook page. We've got a link to it there. And NPR has a link so you can actually sample a little bit more of that music. Fun fact, at the beginning of this year, on the air, I made a sort of New Year's goal to check out lots of new music, you know, new releases this year. Not even a resolution, just a very modest, easy-to-fulfill goal. I have failed, by the way, except for talking to Stephen just now. Joining me in a litany of resolution failures is Central Time producer Jay Carlisle Larson. Hey, JC.
Hi, Rob.
So we talked a little bit about resolutions. You had one. Seemed pretty implementable.
I had one that was not to just fill my time. So don't just go on Facebook arbitrarily. Mm-hmm. Don't go on Instagram, a lot of social media stuff. I failed miserably. I thought it was to like read instead, that kind of thing. And it just didn't happen.
So it wasn't even I'm going to go, you know, rock climbing or something ambitious like that. Instead of spending this time on the computer, I'm going to read more, you're saying.
And I've been there too. Do other things, be okay with the silence. And I just still have fallen into that technology hole.
You try to get out, but it keeps pulling you back in.
It does. It's like a black hole.
How are you going to do it? This weekend, what are you going to do to try to break that?
Oh, I am trying to read right now, but it is...
But you're talking to me.
I'm talking to Rob.
So you have to put the book down. All right. Well, JC, thanks a lot. Good luck making that happen this year.
Thanks, Rob. I appreciate it.
And now how about you? Did you make a New Year's resolution? Did you not accomplish it? What are you going to do to try to get back on track? Let us know. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or send us a message at the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. Stick around. There's a lot more to come after the news. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.